It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. We got lots of questions, lots of feedback. We'll talk about why your password should be like your underwear, or maybe not. And the newest thing with all the kids, it's replacing or supplementing robots.txt, security.txt. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 632, recorded Tuesday, October 10th, 2017. The DNSSEC Challenge. Security Now is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/securitynow. And by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Check out this week's menu and get $30 off your first delivery with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/securitynow. It's time for Security Now, the show where we protect you and your loved ones online with the help of the man in charge, GRC.com, Gibson himself.
Someone sent me a tweet saying, "I'm disturbed by the fact that you're saluting with your left hand."
Oh,
and
but you're not. You're live longing and prospering.
That's right. That's right. And the problem is, I got the microphone here in my blocking my right hand, and it's like, oh, okay.
I never even thought of that, but you know, did you ever serve in the armed forces? I don't think so. Did you?
Never did. Boy Scout was as close as I got, to remember that it was the Boy Scout salute was left-handed. So
was it?
You know, that's kind of what
maybe
I'm doing.
It is.
I don't know. They both seem trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, is courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent.
That is our man, Steve Gibson from GRC.
I've said that for quite a while.
.com. But you remember, it's burning your brain, isn't it?
It is, yes, indeed. So we've got episode 632 today, which I titled the DNSSEC Challenge. DNSSEC is, of course, DNS security. And the occasion of this is the punting for what was planned to be tomorrow's major key rollover from – it was going to be the 2017 key signing key rollover from – which has – where we've had 7 years since 2010 was where the existing keys were first put online. And the ICANN punted because they realized, whoops, we're not ready yet.
Oh.
So
this is big key exchange ceremony that where they do the weird thing. Is that the one?
No. That's a whole in plain sight, no way for any one party to compromise because it's so important that we get that right. This is an automated process for rolling keys and anyway, that's what we're going to get into. I want to talk about sort of remind people where we are, why this is. It's 20 years old. I mean, it was 1997, 20 years ago, that the first RFC for DNSSEC appeared because it was clear that we needed to be able to secure the domain name system. And I've often talked about all the advantages if we ever get to a truly secured global lookup system, which is what this promises, you know, how many things we can do. So, for example, among them, we are able to move away from this problem with there being literally many hundreds of root certificate authorities, all of whom our browsers must trust, because if DNS were secure, a website domain could publish its own public key rather than having this whole chain of trust system where the public key is signed by an authority, and because we trust the authority, then we trust its signature. So all kinds of things get like can be done that we can't do now. But we're not ready yet after 20 years. And so I want to sort of put that into context and talk about that. And of course, we've got a lot of news. We're going to take a look at a well-handled breach response at Discus, or Discuss. I'm not sure how you pronounce it.
I think
it.
They say Discuss.
They probably do.
I had this whole conversation with them.
Yeah, I don't think it's an Olympic event. I think it's a discussion board. Yeah. So, yes.
Spelled with a Q. That's the confusion. Yeah.
And we have a rather horrifying mistake that Apple made in the implementation of their newer APFS encrypted file system and the difficulty for each individual user in cleaning up after it. We've talked sometimes in the past about the famous robots.txt file. It gets a brilliant new companion coming soon. We've got somewhat shocking news about Windows XP, or is it?
There's news about Windows XP?
Believe it or not, my jaw dropped.
It's like saying there's news about Abraham Lincoln.
Precisely, okay. And wait till you hear it.
All right.
So we also have a declared end of life for Firefox for Windows XP, which a lot of our listeners tweeted to me saying, God, Steve.
That's the last browser, right?
Well, I'm staying with it, but it's not until next summer. So hopefully by then I will be moved over. And actually, there's an event which will be causing that to happen.
Wait a minute, moved over from Windows XP?
To Windows 7.
Wow, you are so modern.
Kicking and screaming all the way, So we also have the sage security thought of the day, courtesy of Matthew Green, an update on the Orville, thanks to many of our listeners who said, okay, wait a minute. We also have some closing the loop comments, including a recommendation of the best series we ever did on Security Now in response to one of our listeners' questions about, like, what would I recommend he go back and listen to?
This is good because I know what I would nominate. I bet it's the same.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
And then once we get all that done, we're going to talk to what we will finish the podcast taking a look at why it has taken 20 years to still not yet get DNS secured.
Yeah. Because I feel like I thought DNSSEC was like done.
It's apparently not. In fact, I've got charts and statistics and numbers and things about like where it is.
Wow.
But it's just a heavy lift.
It fixes a multitude of woes.
And then, believe it or not, when you think after you would think in our 13th year, Leo, we would have pretty much seen any possible picture of the week. But we're going to be introducing underpants.
All right, more with Steve in just a moment. First, a word from our sponsor for this half of Security Now, Rocket Mortgage. Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. You know Quicken Loans. I think a lot of people think of Quicken Loans Arena. They own the naming rights to, Cleveland, right? But they're based in Detroit, and they're really a neat, high-tech, forward-thinking company. Quicken Loans is busy revitalizing downtown Detroit. Good for them. They're also the number two lender in the country for home loans. And they're the number one lender in the country when it comes to J.D. Power customer satisfaction. 7 years running, number one in customer satisfaction. I should tell you something. They really are good. They're beloved by their customers. And now we geeks have a little bit something extra to love them for, and that's Rocket Mortgage, created by Quicken Loans to make it completely easy, trustworthy, and kind of just confidence building to get a home loan. I know it's a little scary. It's the biggest purchase of your life buying that new home, unless you are stupid enough to build a downtown video studio, but that's another story for another day. It's for most of us, the biggest expenditure you'll ever make. And you want to make sure you're getting, most people don't write a check. They're getting a loan. You want to make sure you're getting a loan from a good company. You also, and take it from me, because I've bought a few homes over my years. Let's see, this is probably like sixth or seventh. And it's always painful. It's the mortgage is always the worst part of it. Last house we bought 4 years ago, Lisa and I bought the house we live in right now. We got a loan from a big bank. It took months, literally. I'm not even exaggerating. They kept coming back for more information and more information. We were faxing them documents from the boat. We had to call. We were on a cruise. We had to call because we thought, oh, it'll be over by then. Couldn't take that long. Wrong. We had Lisa's sister faxing him stuff. It was just crazy. Now you can do it all in minutes. Like, get the whole thing done with Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. You don't even have to, you know, find documents to fax them. No. No, that's crazy talk. This is the 21st century. What you do is you go to rocketmortgage.com/security now. That's the website. And you just give them some basic information. They say, is this you? Yes. Do you give us permission to access your bank account and financial records? Yes. That's it. That's it. They have trusted partners with all the big financial institutions. They get everything they need to know very quickly, very easily. They crunch the numbers, and based on your income, assets, and credit, they can do this in literally minutes. And actually, that's an exaggeration. It's really seconds because it's all computerized. And they will come up with all the loan options for which you qualify, and you can pick the term, you can pick the rate, how much down you're going to put, and that's it. You're approved. You got the loan in minutes. It makes me feel like, what was I thinking? But Rocket Mortgage wasn't around yet. Next time, for sure. Whether you're buying or refinancing, your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is here to save your bacon. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. Go to rocketmortgage.com/security now. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030. I know you're probably not this very moment. You're listening to Security Now, buying a house. So bookmark it. Put it in your Firefox. Rocket, that way you'll have it. Next time you're at an open house and you go, hey, you know, we really ought to buy this. Rocketmortgage.com/security now. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. Rocketmortgage.com/security now. Okay, Steve, I've got it queued up.
So our picture of the week appears to be authentic. Several people sent it to me, of course. It's got the logo in the upper left-hand corner of Shell Oil, and it's got the coloration of Shell Oil's corporate colors. So it looks to me like it's real. And the big message here, they have some site they call Think Secure. And, you know, that's certainly a good concept to be promoting.
This is probably an internal document, right, given to Shell employees.
Yes. Yes. And, in fact, the photo that I saw that I snipped this from was sort of like a poster that you'd pass by as you were walking down the hall and think, okay, where am I working? Because this says, treat your passwords like your underpants. I'm not kidding.
Well, wait a minute.
Like your underpants.
Take them off before you go to bed? What? I don't what?
Change them often.
Okay.
Which sounds like a good idea.
Yeah.
Don't leave them lying around.
Yes.
Just a little personal hygiene.
Put them in the hamper. Yeah.
And this is, I think, this really a third one I'm really agreeing with. Don't share them. So, you know, keep them to yourself.
Somebody in the chat room said, oh, long underpants, long passwords? No.
Yes, boxers or briefs? Yeah,
I think the point of this is to get the attention of the employees.
It would do that.
Yes.
Yes. It got the attention of the internet, and it certainly got the attention of this podcast. I was tempted to dig in further. It may have been an intranet website that wasn't publicly available.
Yeah.
But for example, they say use different passwords for business and personal purposes. It's like, no, use a different password for
every single thing
you do.
Yeah.
Yes. As we are learning from breach after breach after breach, you just have to use unique passwords. Anyway,
treat your passwords like your underpants. Avoid crappy passwords. Yeah, that's okay. That's one way of putting it. Yeah,
this is going to be the start of a whole new meme. Wow.
And actually, I don't think changing your passwords often is really very good advice, but that's, we've talked about that before.
No, exactly. That was one of the nice things that the IETF finally updated their recommendations for. NIST, right, the NIST updated their recommendations for a couple months ago was, okay, oh, and the guy who was originally, as we discussed on the podcast, the guy who originally just made that up out of whole cloth.
Seems
just
like
said,
a good idea.
That was never really a good idea at all. So I apologize. Wait, you apologize? You screwed up the whole world.
20 years later.
Oh, my Lord.
I just made that one up.
Yeah. And of course, you know, we'll take credit here from the day one of saying, what is that supposed to achieve? What is the possible logic behind that? Because, often discussed.
It is common in corporate environments. In fact, my corporate bosses at iHeartMedia make you change your password every 6 months. So it's still common practice, even though I don't know what it achieves.
Well, and we've discussed how employees end up working around that,
right?
Because they'll change it and then change it back,
right?
And if unless
or they'll
the system
add a
is
one
maintained
to it, or yeah,
exactly,
that's my favorite.
Or okay. Fine. So, Cory Doctorow reported for Boing Boing about what he described as a well-handled security breach at Discuss, D-I-S-C-U-S.
Q-U-S.
It is.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Q-U-S.
Yeah.
Oh, I just missed it. How did I miss that? Well, okay.
I used them for years. So that's how I know. And I remember talking to them. When
D-I-S-Q-U-S. Sure enough. I see it down later. he noted that 5 years ago, back in 2012, the Discuss commenting service suffered an undetected breach of 17.5 million user accounts. Once upon a time, that was a big number. Of course, we were just talking about the 145
billion.
Yeah, and then Yahoo's 3 billion. It's like, how many zeros does it have is the only thing we're really wondering about these days.
Well, I use Discuss. So the idea is it's an add-on, like it was for my WordPress blog, that lets people comment on the blog, and it pulled in social media. It was actually a really neat idea. But in order to comment on Discuss, you had to have an account with Discuss. So this is a lot of end users commenting on blogs, basically.
Right. So Troy Hunt, who is a security researcher we have been following and often who comes up in our news, he's the guy who created the Have I Been Pwned site and service. It was through his work that he discovered and disclosed the breach just recently, this five-year-old breach. So these passwords had gotten loose and nobody knew about it. So Troy was extremely happy with Discuss's response, so much so that his blog posting was titled, "Discuss Demonstrates How to Do Breach Disclosure Right," title of his posting. And he said, 23 hours and 42 minutes from initial private disclosure to Discuss to public notification and impacted accounts proactively protected. And then just to sort of put this in context, he said, think about everything that had to happen within this less than 24 hours, just shy of 24 hours. He says, I had to get a response and establish a communication channel. He says, I had to get the data to them securely. And he said, friends, over Australian internet speeds. They had to download and review the data. They had to establish the legitimacy of the data. They had to ensure that there was no ongoing risk in their system. They had to invalidate passwords that had been exposed, 17.5 million. They had to contact the impacted users in the, whose passwords had been exposed, and they had to prepare the communication of this disclosure, all which happened within a day. Thus, relative to the other organizations that he has informed in the past, he was very impressed. He wrote, "When I look at how Discuss handled their intent, they ticked so many of the boxes. It was easy to report to them." And by the way, this comes back to the soon-to-be adopted companion to the robots.txt file that we'll be talking about. So it was easy to report to them. They applied urgency. He said, "More than I can honestly say I've seen any company do before under similar circumstances. They disclosed early, earlier than anyone could have reasonably expected." Again, he says normally he thinks of 72 hours as the gold standard. They did it in less than 24. They protected impacted accounts very quickly by resetting the passwords of those that had been disclosed as a consequence of this breach. They were entirely transparent, he wrote. "There was never a moment," he said, "where I thought they were attempting to spin this in their favor at the expense of the truth." And of course, as we've often covered here, you know, I'm rough on companies where they really seem to be hedging. It's like, okay, come on, you know, I mean, when they're trying to downplay the severity and later it comes out, whoops, it was, you know, much bigger than it was originally believed to be. He said they provided details. The passwords were salted SHA-1 hashes, he wrote, which is not a pretty story to tell in this day and age, but they told it truly regardless. And in their defense, 5 years ago, yeah, okay, SHA-1, if you salted it and you iterated it, that was probably good. I don't know that it was iterated, but at least it was per user salt. So that was good security practice at the time. And who knows what they're doing now, but it was those hashes back then that were the ones that were disclosed. And finally, he wrote, they apologized. He said it was one of the first things they said. They owned this incident from the outset and didn't attempt to divert blame elsewhere. So bravo to those guys. You couldn't ask for, you know, as we've often said here, mistakes happen. Anybody can make a mistake. What you can be held to account for, I think, is first the policy of that you set forth, and also how you deal with a mistake. And you know, these guys did the right thing, so bravo. And you know, it's not as if losing a Discuss password was, you know, life threatening. It's not like Equifax. It's, you know, it's an add-on discussion board system. Still, you'd like to keep it secure so that people aren't impersonating you or messing around with your account.
And they may have had credit card numbers for, I mean, you have to pay for it as the website user.
Ah, right.
So they may have had for a much smaller number of people.
If the breach included that information,
I don't know if it did or not. But they had my credit card number, for instance. I mean, an old one, but
yeah. So, and while we're on the topic of anyone can make a mistake, some are more embarrassing than others. Apple issued an update to its High Sierra desktop OS last Thursday. They called it the macOS High Sierra 10.13 supplemental update, which repaired two dangerous bugs in that OS, both which exposed user passwords, but in different ways. In the first case, if you had created a new APFS, that's the Apple file system, with an encrypted volume under High Sierra, and then set anything at all as the password hint. So you know how you create a password, and oftentimes you're offered the opportunity of giving yourself something that would be meaningful to you to help you remember, hopefully, which of the billion you have. Even better, you can't remember it, and you stored it in a password manager somewhere. On the other hand, if you can't get into your encrypted volume in order to get to your password manager, that won't help you. So you'd have to store it somewhere else. But the point is, if you use the hint feature, then whoops, your password itself was stored as the hint in plain text.
Oh, that's terrible.
It's not good. That means anyone, I mean, it's like, wow, how did this get by QA? Yikes. That means anyone could have gotten your password simply by clicking on the show hint button. And they really should have just relabeled it. Show my password.
Show password. Yeah, there you go.
So even and I mean, and so, yes, it's a bug, obviously. Somewhere the intent was to take what was in the provided hint field and copy it into hint storage. Instead, they used the wrong variable. They copied the unobfuscated, unencrypted, you know, I'm sure they take the password and like hash it like crazy iteratively in order to do a really great job of securing it. Unfortunately, they took the pre-obfuscated user-provided plain text password and stored that in the hint record.
It's more embarrassing than dangerous. Well, I'll tell you why. First of all, somebody obviously had to have physical access to your system.
True.
But also, now, Renee was talking about this on MacBook quickly.
That is what you're protecting. You are protecting physical access to your system.
Yeah, it's file fault. It's protecting encrypting the hard drive. But I think it only showed up on a second encryption partition, not the first. Because in order to see it, you'd have to be able to boot the first, run the disk utility, and then you'd get the password for the second one. That's what I think Renee told me. So I may be misquoting this. Anyway, it's not a – I mean, somebody has a physical access to your system.
Well, but remember, that's what it's protecting.
Right. No, so that's why you encrypt. No,
it's no protection for what it's protecting.
Right.
So
– yeah, it's a mistake.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely.
So – and what's a little disturbing is that it's quite burdensome to recover from that. You have to
rebuild.
Install the 10.13 supplemental update. Yeah. Then you have to create an encrypted backup of the data in your affected APFS volume. Then you open the disk utility, select the encrypted volume in the sidebar, unmount the volume, then erase it, then type in a new name for the volume, change it to APFS, and then back to encrypted in order to sort of like flush things out, then enter a new password in the dialog, now under the fixed system, add a hint if you choose. This time, it's safe to do so. Then you apparently click erase, and then you watch it do that. Then once it's done, you restore your data from the backup to the volume. So, yikes. It would have been nice if there were some way to automate it, but I guess there's nowhere to put that data while it's doing all
of
this.
A lot of people won't be bit because it shows up in the add APFS volume command in disk utility. So it isn't for your primary volume. If you turn on file
and
vault,
you only have one, yes.
Which is how most people do it. Very rarely do you add a second APFS volume and then encrypt it. And the good news is you do it probably on an external drive, so this isn't as laborious of a fix as it sounds, because you'd have a second external drive, move it over, blah 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 blah. But
that does also explain kind of how it got loose.
Yeah,
I mean how it got. You know, it's a more subtle bug than if
not
it was
many
the primary.
People would use this. Right.
Right. Right. Right. Good. Yeah. And the second problem was one that was discussed a couple of weeks ago about the problem with the in the password chain, I can't remember what Apple calls it, the keychain, yes, which was also fixed in 10.13, which improved the protection that that was being offered.
Use keychain, so that's, you know, that's a fairly important technology.
Yeah, and in fact, I don't think it's possible to use Mac OS, is it, without keychain?
No, it automatically puts stuff in there. But I use it, and many do additionally, as a kind of a password manager. So,
right.
Because it will generate passwords and store them for you. I also use it as a certificate manager. for when I use S/MIME certificates. So it's a pretty important technology. Not any more important than File Vault. That's important too. Both of these.
And it's nice that it's built into the system, so users. I mean, and it's something that has received a lot of Apple security attention over the years. So it's a safe place to put things.
Yeah.
Okay. So. We've talked in the past, but not for a long time because it's not high tech. But good answers, good solutions don't have to be about the robots.txt file. What happened in the early days of the internet when we began to have automated web crawlers, also called spiders, which is, for example, how AltaVista and the early search engines and, of course, Google all work, is they send automated agents out to go rifling around through people's websites, looking at pages, indexing them, and thus being able, when we make a search query, to say, oh, those words you're looking for, we happen to find over here. Well, no human did that. A bot roaming around the internet did that. The problem then arose that there were places on a website where a robot should not go. First of all, you could have dumb robots that would follow every link, even if they were circular. So a robot could follow, could like go to a normal page, then record all the outbound links from that page, which might refer to page 2, and page 2 might refer back to page 1. So if the logic wasn't good, the robot could just get stuck in an infinite loop and be essentially pounding on someone's server with no end. There were other places where, especially in the early days, when servers were not high powered, or when they had very inefficient interpreters, doing some active content stuff put a big burden on the server. And then, for example, you might have an e-commerce site or an e-commerce area where it made no sense for a bot to go in there because it just, there was nothing in there for them to see. So this all of these problems got handled with a convention that was established, the robots.txt file. By convention, it sits on the root, that is the, www.grc.com/, the root of the server, and well-behaving bots. And, basically today, any bot, any automation, when it wants to go to a site, it assumes the existence. Normally there are not links to it. It just assumes the existence of a robots.txt file in the root, in the base directory of the site, which it retrieves. So it asks for that, and the robots.txt file has a simple but well and time-honored, well-established format where you're able to specify which so-called user agents you want to apply a set of rules. So you are able to sort of tune the rules for who's coming in. Again, it's all informational. None of this is enforced. It's basically saying, we would appreciate you robots out there if you respected our wishes and did not go digging around in the following places. And so, for example, grc.com has one where there's just a bunch of stuff where it's better if they don't go wandering in there because there's nothing very interesting and it could screw things up. So we've had that for years. In what I think is a brilliant concept, we're going to be getting security.txt. Security.txt will similarly be a text file located in the root directory of a website, which is meant not to inform robots, but to inform researchers. It will create a unified, centralized place for a security researcher to determine who to call, who to send email to, who to inform if a problem is a security problem is found with the site. And that it is so simple, it is just brilliant.
It's also a promise in a way, which I think security researchers are rightly so paranoid these days, because you can get arrested for pen testing or, you know, working on a system and finding exploits. So it's a promise to the researcher. No, it's okay. Let us know. And we, I mean, I don't know if it's a binding promise, but I that's the main reason I like this. A researcher won't be put off from, you know, looking for flaws and reporting them.
Right. And well, and even Troy, in his previous note about Discus, he said, you know, I was able to contact them more easily because I had a pre-existing relationship.
Right.
But, you know, very often obscure researchers don't have a contact at some random company. And, you know, knowing that that you could put into the browser www.domain, whatever it is, .com or IT or, you know, who knows what, ru/security.txt, and immediately be shown a couple lines that provide you the information. So, for example, you can have one or more contact fields where there can be an email address like security@example.com, a phone number to call, a page that refers you to their security policy or for additional information. Also, there's an encryption field. You can say encryption colon, and then for example, they can provide the PGP, their PGP public key, which you're then able to use to encrypt your report to them so that it can be sent to them. And as we enumerated in the previous story, Troy needed to, because this is sensitive information, he needed to have a means of sending this information to them securely. So this provides that. And also, what is the site's disclosure policy? So, for example, in the formal emerging RFC, it says it allows a company to specify the disclosure policy, where the type could be full, which would stand for full disclosure, partial for partial disclosure, and none means you do not want to disclose reports after the issue has been resolved, meaning how does the company intend to manage the information that you have provided? Will they fully disclose it, partially disclose it, or just, you know, not say anything at all? And then also, what is their acknowledgement policy? The fourth type of field is acknowledgement, where they provide a page to, you know, like their Hall of Fame or whatever, where people who have helped them are being disclosed. So I just think, you know, so simple. As I said, really good ideas don't have to be complicated. And this is just great.
Yeah.
Again, voluntary, nothing's requiring it. But you can imagine at some point in the future, we'll start getting a list of sites that do provide a security.txt file in their root and those that don't. And be sort of asking those who don't, hey, why not? You know, it's so simple to do. So, yay. back sort of on the topic of old OSs are oh so very hard to kill. As we were talking at the top of the show, there's actually news about Windows XP. Believe it or not, Leo, and I know you're sitting down and you're not, we don't have to worry about you being centered over the ball anymore. So no worry about you being capsized.
Okay, I'm bracing myself.
Windows XP is going to be getting TLS version 1.1 and 1.2.
Oh my God. That's actually great.
I know.
Is that Microsoft doing that?
It's Microsoft. It's in their official blog, and I've got the link to it in the show notes. Microsoft has backported TLS version 1.1 and 1.2 to support XP, and it will be appearing in the Windows update channels. Wow. Okay, now we need to add a little bit of a caveat, because remember that this is for the POS ready, the point of sale ready.
Oh, it's not all XP.
Right.
Yeah, I was going to say that's quite an acknowledgement that people are still using XP, but it isn't. It's POS XP.
Correct. So and that it better explains the context of this. So what's happening is Microsoft has recognized, and no doubt there is pressure behind the scenes on them, that there are turnkey kiosks and point of sale systems still in operation throughout the world, which are beginning to experience connectivity problems due to the aging TLS protocol support in Windows XP. I was finally forced to move to Service Pack 3 because SP2, where I had been happily for years, did not understand SHA-256. And I was back on SHA-1 support in the cryptographic libraries of Windows XP. I'm on Service Pack 3 with no problems. SHA-256 is understood. But I'd like to have TLS 1.1 and 1.2 support. So when I restart my system soon, I'll be getting it, because my system has been flagged as POS ready. I have several WinXP machines around
That was that thing you did, right?
Yes, it's just a registry key entry. Anybody who is still using Windows XP can Google WinXP POS ready 2009.
I'm amazed that's still working. I would have thought Microsoft would have turned that off right away. Right?
I don't think they really want to.
No,
I mean,
they acknowledge there's people using it, and this is good. That's good.
Yeah. And on the topic of XP, Firefox has formally announced on the 4th, so it was last Wednesday, the day after last week's podcast, that next June of 2018, which gives me time, and I need a deadline. We know I need a deadline. I was forced to Service Pack 3 of Windows XP because SHA-1 was finally dying. And I thought, okay, I'm going to have to do this. So that'll be good for me. I'm not leaving Firefox. I still like it. It's getting much faster recently. They're continuing to do things. I just like it more. And so they said last year, we announced that Windows XP and Vista users would be automatically moved to the Firefox Extended Support Release, the ESR, and that's what mine is now, ensuring them continued updates until at least September 2017. Okay, well, that was last month, and I'm still alive. Today, they wrote, last Wednesday, we are announcing June 2018 as the day as the final end of life date.
You're the best known Windows XP user, though, I must say.
The day Steve will finally be forced off of XP, kicking and screaming.
This is the last major browser not to update, right? I mean, Chrome stopped a while ago. Of course, IE stopped a long time ago.
Yeah, and yeah. Chrome keeps – yeah. Every time I fire Chrome up, just to like if I need to do something with it, yeah. It's like, hey – what the hell are you still
who
doing
are you?
On XP? He's like, yeah.
Is this Ted Kaczynski? What is going on here?
So they said, as the final end of life date for Firefox support on Windows. Now, notice it doesn't stop working. So I could maybe get into June into July. But anyway, no, I'll move. On Windows XP and Vista, as one of the few browsers that continues to support Windows XP and Vista, Firefox users on these platforms can expect security updates until that date. Users do not need to take additional action to receive those updates. So okay, that's good for me. I will be, over the next few months, I'll be establishing a remote outpost where I will need to be doing work. And so that'll be good for me. I haven't needed to really take Win 7 seriously yet, but that will cause me to do so more deeply than I have. So I think I'll be kind of okay by the time it takes I have to move. And, you know, I've got this box sitting over here that's just like a dream machine that I haven't had to use yet. So, because that's my Win 7 box. So it'll be good to
You're gonna like Windows 7.
Oh, I do. No, I have it everywhere else, yeah. Just not my main system. Yeah. Yeah. Because Mark Thompson scared me when he made the move because all kinds of stuff broke. Because we both of us have a lot of 16-bit code, and Windows 7 formally abandoned support for 16-bit code, which is like, oh, crap. My editor is, I'm sure. So I have to make the change. But, you know,
Somebody's saying the portable Firefox will continue to run. But there's no reason to think it won't run. It's just it won't get patched.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Precisely. Yeah. Precisely. And, okay, the Sage security thought for the day. It's a sort of a play on the famous Arthur C. Clarke quote. Arthur C. Clarke is famous for having said, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Love that. Matthew Green, our cryptography friend, said, sufficiently advanced incompetence is indistinguishable from malice.
Very nice corollary. We're going to call that Green's corollary.
Yes.
Yes.
Sufficiently advanced incompetence is indistinguishable from malice. And which is actually an important lesson because we often encounter that and phrase it less elegantly than Matthew just did, where, okay, it's not clear that this is evil. It just could be dumb, like really dumb. So, yeah, sufficiently advanced incompetence is indistinguishable from malice.
Love it. And we see a lot of it, God knows.
I think we're at about the midway point for the podcast, Leo. Mm-hmm. So time for our
Is
our
it lunchtime?
Second...
Time to fire up the Blue Apron. Have you, you don't cook. You eat ham sandwiches, right?
I don't eat ham sandwiches, but I
don't.
Well,
you
cook.
Used to. That used to be your staple. Am I wrong?
No, I think you're thinking about somebody else.
No, you always said I have a ham sandwich for lunch. I'm not thinking anybody else. That was you. I have the recordings to prove it.
It's been many years ago.
All right, quick. I'm going to search through Elaine's transcript. All right, so you actually eat real food now.
Yeah.
And I know you've been, you mentioned this last week. I don't think I'm revealing any secrets, but you have a good friend that you maybe would like to impress. Okay.
She cooks.
Oh, well, then I want you to go to blueapron.com and check it out for her because maybe she would like to do this. This is really fun, and I love our Blue Apron. We get our Blue Apron box every week, although it's not a subscription. You get it when you want it. It is a food kit, I guess, the best way to describe it. You get in the box everything you need to make three delicious meals, either for a couple or a family of four. You get the recipe card and every single ingredient with the freshest produce, the most delicious meats, fresh, never frozen. It starts with the ingredients, exactly what you need, no waste, no muss, no fuss. You need 2 tablespoons of soy sauce, you get 2 tablespoons. You need 1 rib of celery, you get 1 rib of celery. And then you whip up the best meal. And you know what's nice about cooking it is it fills the house with these amazing aromas. It's great for date night. You want to impress somebody. Oh, my mouth starts watering every time I do these. Blue Apron's mission. And by the way, happy 5th anniversary to Blue Apron is to create a community of home cooks, a sustainable food system, because they use 150 local farms, fisheries, ranchers across the United States. The seafood is sourced sustainably. The beef, chicken, and pork come from responsibly raised animals. The produce is sourced from farms that practice regenerative farming. I mean, they really work hard to make the whole thing from beginning to end conscious and aware and delicious. And, of course, there's a freshness guarantee. Every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they'll make it right. And I have to say, I've always been impressed by, I don't know how they get the most perfect produce and vegetables and meats in there, and it's always wonderful. Because they're celebrating, I love this, their fifth anniversary, they're bringing back their top 20 all-time recipes. What? This is so exciting. The most favorite recipes of all are for a limited time available now on Blue Apron. One of the things I like about Blue Apron is that they don't repeat, you know, that you're always getting new and interesting stuff. Actually, tonight we're going to have this one. Cajun spiced catfish sandwich with roasted broccoli and remoulade sauce. You'll find new ingredients, new recipes, new ways of cooking. It'll expand your repertoire and you'll get amazing meals for less than $10 per person per meal in less than 40 minutes. Fennel crusted pork chops and fig compote, anybody, with sauteed kale and farro salad? My goodness. Right now, go to blueapron.com/security now. Get $30 off your first delivery with free shipping. You're going to love how good it tastes and feels to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. All-time customer favorite recipes right now. blueapron.com/security now. Get $30 off your first delivery with free shipping. blueapron.com/security now.
I will say that it is popular among those in my neighborhood because I often see the box sitting on their front porch.
They're the number one now of food delivery and cooking service in the country. They're really, really taking off. They went public, right? BlueApron.com. I'm glad. I want them to do well because I'm kind of hooked on them.
So I wanted to give an update after panning the Orville after not being able to tolerate more than about 5 minutes
Seth
of it.
Seth MacFarlane's Star Trek homage a little bit, right?
Yes. And I put it back in TiVo. So, and I missed the first five, I think, but I may go back and see. Anyway, I just wanted to follow up. Dan Edwards wrote, first episode of The Orville was a train wreck. Oh. Episode two is much better, and three and four are fantastic.
Oh.
Very Roddenberry-esque.
Oh, which you can't say for Discovery, right?
No. Al Spalding said, The Orville had eye rolls at first. I pushed through, and episode three turned out to be good with a Roddenberry-worthy twist at the end. And finally, Adam Van Quick said, you said The Orville wasn't your cup of tea, or cup O.T. after viewing a few minutes of the first episode. You may start to enjoy it from episode two on. He said, I find The Orville more drama than comedy. I think episodes three through five would hold your interest. So I just wanted to say, for the record, thank you to our listeners. I will give it another try because, I mean, if it's gotten more serious and not just so, you know, goofy, then, yeah, I think that sounds like it could be worthwhile.
All right. I haven't watched it, but I will.
Should I just skip
the first episodes and go right to
sounds
three?
Sounds like you should.
Yeah.
Sounds like you're not missing anything.
Yeah.
And just, you know, save yourself some pain because, oh, boy. I mean, even these guys agree, ouch, for number one was just like, okay, wrong.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Boy, if it's Roddenberry-esque, that says
C
a lot.
Alex in the chat room says, it's amazing, more Star Trek than any of the modern renditions. And, of course, it doesn't take itself too seriously.
Wow.
Hmm.
That sounds worth watching.
Hmm.
So, okay. We've often covered through the years my interest in energy storage. You know, supercapacitors, batteries in the lab, all kinds of stuff that have never happened. And so I just wanted to touch on just sort of for the sake of not saying anything about it, some researchers at Rice University who had discovered, believe it or not, that adding a bit of asphalt to existing lithium metal batteries can allow them to charge between 10 and 20 times faster than our current lithium ion batteries. The lead researcher was a guy named James Tour, who was quoted in the press coverage saying, quote, the capacity of these batteries is enormous, but what is really remarkable is that we can bring them from zero charge to full charge in 5 minutes rather than the typical 2 hours or more needed with other batteries. And he revealed another significant benefit. The asphalt additive mitigated the formation of lithium dendrites, which we've talked about. That's the cause of these explosions, because what happens is when those dendrites, which are lithium and thus conductive metal, when they end up creeping through the electrolyte to bridge the two electrodes, that's when you get a fire and explosions and so forth. So the addition of the asphalt mitigates that. Anyway, so I just, you know, who knows whether this will ever happen? Like so much of the other power storage stuff that we've touched on here over the years, it's still stuck in the lab. It may never see the light of day. On the other hand, maybe it's almost better if it doesn't, because we know if we end up with asphalt in our batteries, we're going to have to be putting up with stories saying things like paving the way to a better battery. So we'll see whether that happens or not. While I was going through all of my Twitter backlog, I ran across a couple mentions of SpinRite that I wanted to share and thank our listeners. Someone named Floris apparently used SpinRite to really help himself. He said, I dug out my very, very old executable of SpinRite. He said at SGGRC executable, I'm sure he meant SpinRite, to try to fix a broken drive. Hooked it to an old WinXP, yay, machine. After only 4 hours of constant rattling noises, it made massive progress finding tens of gigs and tens of thousands of pictures. And in his tweet, he then posted something that looks like Mac OS. I guess that's what it is. I mean, based on the three different shaded buttons in the upper left that are, you know, close, minimize, and maximize, showing it compressing 3,200 items into pictures 2017, 5,398 into pictures 2016, and so forth. So tens of thousands of photos that he says SpinRite helped to recover from that drive. Also, Tyson, I don't know how to pronounce his last name, Cluggy, C-L-U-G-Y. He said, he tweeted, PC locked up.
I hope it's not Kluge.
I hope not, yes. But that's the handle that he chose for himself.
It could
be, yeah. He said, PC locked up several times this week, wouldn't boot today. Less than an hour with SpinRite, and it's made a full recovery. Thanks. So Tyson, whatever your last name is, thank you for sharing. And finally, Neutron John, who I don't think is the name his parents gave him, said, just bought, what should we call our son? How about Neutron?
Neutron John, I like
that
it.
That sort of sounds, but wasn't that the name of a dog on the Jetsons? Was that Neutron?
Well, there was Jimmy Neutron. That was a cartoon show.
Johnny Neutron. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So he said, just bought SpinRite and wanted to give a shout out to a tutorial that helped me to use it on a Mac. It was the tutorial's titled Running SpinRite 6.0 on Mac OS, and link in the show notes. And looks like it's very recent. KevinStreet.co.uk. Yep, you found it, Leo.
Yeah.
And it's dated 9/11. So September 11th, just a month ago, running SpinRite 6.0 on Mac OS. It's got very nice walkthrough instructions. And Kevin, in his blog posting, says, you know, I found various things on the net about how to run SpinRite on a Mac, but he pulled it all together and packaged it
this
nicely.
This is great.
So,
this is great.
Yeah. Very nice
and
walkthrough.
And you approve. So, this is a Gibson approved.
Yes, it looked, in fact, there was, he found something called Play on Mac.
Yeah, I use that, yeah.
Yes, and that's what I've been looking for Squirrel, because we also want Squirrel to be able to run on a Mac until someone writes a native Squirrel client. So I had asked the Squirrel gang earlier, like, you know, has anyone packaged the Wine subsystem that would allow a Windows app to be used easily by a Mac user? And so Play on Mac is exactly that.
It's
so when I ran across,
that's nice.
Yes, yeah. It's free and exactly no Windows license required and so forth. So
it's it's just like Wine. It's a API.
Correct. Well, it is Wine. It is a Yeah, it's sort of a packaged version of all the Wine work, which itself is just amazing.
Yeah.
I am verifying that Squirrel, the Windows Squirrel client, runs under Wine. We got guys using it under Linux now, but for Windows users, being who they are, we just sort of need to make it easier to use on a Mac. So it looks like Play on Mac will be able to do that. So yeah, so Neutron John, thank you for bringing that to our attention, and of course. Probably won't be 6.1 because I'm not gonna delay its release at all. The instant I get it running at high speed on and direct to the hardware using the AHCI hardware, I'm gonna push that out, and that'll be the first of a series of updates. But getting it to run on the Mac, that'll probably be 6.2, so it runs natively on the Mac. And then I'm thinking 6.3 will be adding native USB hardware support in order to bring USB attached drives up to the same maximum performance. So anyway, subject to change, but the goal is to essentially apologize for this having taken me so long to get Squirrel finished by accelerating the release schedule for Spinrite and not holding it back while I put more things in, because I can just always do more of them. And we have a couple of interesting closing the loop bits, including what we talked about and teased at the beginning of the show. Josh Freeman asked, been listening for years, but what are some of the key great episodes from the early years of Security Now that I should listen to? And I would argue that it's we started it with episode 233 titled Let's Design a Computer.
Yep, same one. Yep.
Yep, I thought so. and what we did over the course of, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 episodes was we went from first principles and starting all the way through. So 233 was Let's Design a Computer. And in fact, my description from back then was to understand the advances made during 50 years of computer evolution, we need to understand computers 50 years ago. In this first installment of a new Security Now series, we design a 50-year-old computer. In future weeks, we will trace the factors that shaped their design during the four decades that followed. And so 235 is introduces machine language. 237, indirection, the power of pointers. 239, stacks, registers, and recursion. 241, hardware interrupts. 247, the multiverse. Multi-threading, multi-processing, multitasking, multi-cores. 250, operating systems. 252, risky business, RISCY, where we talk about risk processors. And then finally, 254, what we'll do for speed, where we talk about the insane things that our chip manufacturers have done in order to improve the performance of their machines as users kept pushing for more. So it's a reference set of really sort of classic a walkthrough of the evolution of computers over time, which I would recommend both to Josh and anybody else who against all reason is looking for additional content.
And the reason it's alternating numbers is back then, back in the day,
every
other show would be a Q&A show. So we couldn't do it continuously. We don't do that anymore. They're all kind of.
Well, there's just so much news, Leo. Yeah, I don't know how we could skip. How could we skip a week?
Those were better times, simpler times, Steve. This is seven years ago now, but I mean, this was a great series that you did. Really useful. And by the way, because it's 7 years ago, it's audio only. We didn't do video at the time.
Oh, thank goodness.
Yeah, you don't like the video. Never did, I know. And you were right.
Makes me shave every week.
Yeah,
so
that's a good thing.
Yeah, well, and Lori appreciates that now.
Once a week. It's very important.
Yeah. So Paradigm Concepts said, Steve, have you had a chance to review Bitdefender Box? It describes itself as a total home protection device for unlimited IoT devices and lets you roam using your home connection through VPN to your home. And so I have looked at it and I've talked about it briefly, but I'll just remind people because for some reason it must have been in the news or came to people's attention. So, of course, Bitdefender is a well-known, long-standing anti-malware software solution. Bitdefender Box is a hardware system. It's $99 at the moment, but I think it also involves a subscription, so it's a service-oriented solution. I'm always a little skeptical about these turnkey things that you stick in your home, and they always make claims which are difficult to support. Because as we know, as more things go to HTTPS and TLS encryption, it's not possible for a drop-it-in turnkey box to see into those connections unless they were to do a man in the middle. Now, Bitdefender has the advantage of being able to deploy clients on all of your devices. So that's where it gets an advantage over any of the other drop it in and we protect everything, meaning that you can have a Bitdefender client running on your iOS devices, your phone and your pads, on your Android devices, on your Mac and your PC and your Linux machines. So that gives them coverage that a box wouldn't otherwise have. But there is no solution for arbitrary webcams and baby monitors and security systems, you know, the IoT devices where they are not able to install a client. They're making broad IoT inclusive claims. Now, what they can do is look at where the connections are going and what URLs are being looked up, and they do that. So they have a cloud-based bad URLs, bad URLs directory. So their box could flag worrisome remote URLs and domains and blacklist them in order to prevent not only your regular clients, but also all the things you've got in your internal network from accessing worrisome places. So I think in general, with the slight caveat that they're wanting to protect IoT, but I don't see how they can offer the same level of protection, at least with IoT, as they do with all of our other endpoints. Most of the problems that people want protection from are the things they're interacting with more, like their iPhone, their iPad, and their desktop machines and laptops. And if you install the companion Bitdefender client that goes with the box, then you get that too. So yes, if you are a person who wants more of a turnkey solution, you don't mind paying some sort of a subscription fee, and you've got an environment where you'd I would argue maybe the best protection you can get, though you do have to pay for it, this looks like a good solution.
I have to try it.
Yeah. Simon Zarafa, who frequently keeps me informed of things I would otherwise miss, noted that Netgear had a lot of updates. And I went to netgear.com/about/security because I was curious. And wow, yes. A raft of updates. So I know that a lot of Netgear is popular with a lot of our listeners. I wanted to just point people at netgear.com/about/security for anyone who wanted to check to see if these recent things were affected. Maybe if you can go to your Netgear devices management page and just say check for update, it's worth doing so. They normally can't be proactive because there's no way for them to put that news in your face unless maybe they send you email. So you might, you know, post a big wave of updates. It makes sense to just go, if you have a Netgear device on the front line, like a Netgear router with combined Wi-Fi, for example, now would be a good time to go check to see if there's an update, because there might be, and it could be important, especially if the device is there internet facing, because we know what the challenge is of keeping those protected. We're talking about that all the time. Kyle Harden said, excellent show. What do you think of RAID 10 as an alternative to RAID 6 regarding drive failure during rebuild? We were talking last week about, in fact, this was our SpinRite story last week, where somebody had RAID 5, so they had a single drive of redundancy. A drive died, which was okay because the whole system was still running, able to recreate the lost data from all of the other ones. But during the attempted rebuild, he put a new drive in and it was rebuilding the RAID. One of the surviving drives then died. Now he was in trouble, potential full loss. Fortunately, he was able to run SpinRite on that one, bring that one back to life, then reconstruct the RAID and get another full drive of redundancy once again. That led me to talk about RAID 6, where you get two drives of redundancy. And due to the fact that RAID arrays are now so massive and that the rebuild process can be problematical, what the industry has begun to move to RAID 6, which offers two drives of redundancy. And for example, that's what I use at GRC. All of the GRC servers are RAID 6, just because suspenders and belt. RAID 10, which is actually sort of it's a RAID, think of it as RAID 1 and RAID 0. As we know, RAID 0 is striping, where you essentially you take two drives and you see them as one, which is the sum of their sizes. So the idea being you can get a performance benefit by pulling from both drives at once in order to maybe get double the speed depending upon the controller and bandwidth and things. The danger with RAID 0, which gives you, if you had two identical drives, the appearance of one drive of twice the size, is that if either of them now dies, you're in trouble. That is, you've increased the probability of a failure. So by comparison, RAID 1 is mirroring, where you don't get any drive size increase, but you get 100% redundancy. So that if either one fails, the other one is a mirror image, or they are mirror images of each other. That is, you know, they can they contain a complete duplicate of the data. So you're protected against failure. So RAID 1.0 is really the way to think of RAID 10. RAID 1.0 is both of those things. You take four drives, you mirror them, and you RAID zero them. That is, you stripe across each pair and then mirror the pairs. The advantage of that is that it is very low computational overhead. That is, since you're just writing the same data out, you're able to do that very quickly. And when you're reading it, you're able to do it very quickly. Any of the like RAID 5 and RAID 6, there's a computational overhead because you're having to do fancy exclusive ORing functions in order to maintain the less than 100% redundancy which RAID 1 gives you. The more drives in RAID 6, RAID 5, or RAID 6 that you have, the more efficient it is because you only have one drive redundancy over however many total drives. In RAID 1, you've got essentially 50% data loss because you're mirroring the two drives. So anyway, with that background, the benefit is performance. The problem is you're still vulnerable to some failures. RAID 6 can tolerate two failures. RAID 1.0, well, it can tolerate some two-drive failures, but it can't tolerate two drives which are this half of the mirror. So if you sort of think of it as a square, drives mirrored across and then striped down, if the right two drives fail, you're okay. If the wrong two fail, you're hosed. So it's sort of a poor man's higher performance, yet still kind of risky RAID 6. If you can, just working with RAID 6, I think, is better. Or using 5, but be sure to monitor it. You absolutely need to monitor your RAID because you want to detect the first moment there's a problem. And in general, what we're learning overall is that monitoring is a good and important thing to be doing. Two people asked about NAS. VIPX1 asked, what's the best Synology NAS for regular home? And he said OS image backups using Acronis. And then somebody else, Sergeant Wilco, said, hiya, I know you've mentioned it on Security Now, but I can't find it. Which NAS do you use and recommend? Well, so first of all, we should mention that Drobo is a sponsor of the TWiT network, and I love it. That's what I've got here, and I know you do too, Leo.
Yeah.
I had an experience that I'll share at GRC's Level 3 service. I played around with FreeNAS on Unix and thinking that it was like some magic, amazing thing. And I soon realized that it was just a thin little coating on top of just standard Unix, which already supports all of these various network attached storage protocols. I mean, you have NFS and Samba. There are DLNA servers for Unix. So, and what I really wanted was ZFS. I am so impressed with ZFS that it's what I'm standardizing on moving forward for my Unix-based machines. And so my feeling is, taking any machine, I guess I would separate by user type. Certainly Drobo gives you a sponsor of the network, gives you a simple to use, no muss, no fuss, drop in solution with features that nobody else has. Not even, ZFS allows you to arbitrarily change the size of one of the drives just on a whim, and the system sort of says, oh, look, we have more space. And then it like reallocates it, with this whole amazing RAID-based system that the Drobo sports. But if you're more techie and you like the idea of taking, your own retired PC and bringing up a solution, I would look at whatever you know Unix system you like. Maybe it's Linux. For me, it's FreeBSD, and just setting up a ZFS system and just rolling your own. Basically, bringing up the various protocols that you need for your network, and you know you end up with something that is all yours, that you understand, that you built, and thanks to ZFS, which just nails redundant file storage in a highly scalable way. Although it needs a lot of RAM, that's the glitch I hit as I was learning about it. This particular system I was trying to bring it up on was an x86 Xeon, and while it had a lot of horsepower, it was limited to 4 gig. And it
well, that's
and
not nearly you, enough.
You really do need you need a lot of RAM.
Yeah, this is a 32 gig machine that I built for my FreeBSD, and that's
nice.
That's kind of minimal.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean this is non-trivial. That's the other side of it.
Correct.
Not to give a plug to Drobo or even something like Synology, which I really love. It uses BTRFS, which is also a copy on write file system. But ZFS is the king of the hill here. This is what Apple is supposedly offering now with APFS. It's got snapshots. It's got, I mean, I feel like a modern file system.
A state-of-the-art OS.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, a state-of-the-art
file system. Yeah.
Yes.
So one hopes that we'll see some improvements across the board. I'd love to see ZFS on Linux. It's really kind of not ready for prime time in my experience. It's really a FreeBSD thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and finally, David Lemire, he said, regarding huge root trust stores, any practical way to clear out, then add back individually what's actually needed by the user? And that's a great question. If I weren't way overcommitted with finishing Squirrel and then getting immediately back to work on SpinWrite, I could solve that problem, or someone else could. The key is that the initial handshake of TLS cannot, by definition, be encrypted. So it's possible to passively monitor outside of the system. For example, a router could do it, or something attached to the router, like a Raspberry Pi, could passively monitor all the traffic on your network and compile a list of the signers of the certificates that you're actually using. So you could, for example, set that up and watch for a year, for example, because I mean, you know, we're not CAs and the trusted root store, they're not going away anytime soon. So you could watch for a long time until you'd notice that, oh, look, it had gone sort of exponential. That is, you hadn't added any new ones for the last 3 months. Then you could say, okay, I now have a snapshot of the roots all of our systems in the network actually use, and remove all the others. So in which case, you'd probably be able to function with a minimal trust. And especially if you went to a site that you knew you'd visited before and got a warning that this certificate was not trusted, be like, whoa, wait a minute. I was there yesterday. That would immediately clue you to the fact to the possibility that you had received an illegitimate certificate from what should be a valid domain. So the only way I could see to do this practically would be to audit for a while, and which is feasible to do, monitoring the network, because as I said, that initial certificate handshake is in the clear. It isn't until after that happens that you then bring up the encrypted tunnel between the endpoints. So someone passively observing could build a list of all of the certificates and their signers, and then move that into the trust store pulling all the other ones out. You'd still want to have a, I mean, you could, it's certainly the case you could occasionally encounter a problem, but you could deal with that on an as happens basis. And if you ended up getting surprised, it would be a good way of noting that, wait a minute, why is this site suddenly asking for a root cert that it didn't ask for yesterday or a few days ago? So that would bring that to your attention. Anyway, I don't know if such a thing exists. If it does, I'm sure our listeners will let me know, and I'll share it on the podcast. So great question, and it would be handy to have.
Yeah.
Okay, so why 20 years after RFC 2065, which was titled Domain Name System Security Extensions, which, by the way, is what DNSSEC stands for, DNS Security. Why don't we have it today? The goals, even back then, were well understood. 20 years ago, in 1997, the abstract for that RFC starts by saying the domain name system has become a critical operational part of the internet. Yeah, no kidding. Yet it has no strong security mechanisms to assure data integrity or authentication. Extensions to the DNS are described as, it's funny too, because every time I see the DNS, is it the DNS or DNS? Well, technically, since DNS stands for domain name system, it's the domain name system. So, okay. Extensions to the DNS are described that provide the, that is described herein, they meant, that provide these services to security-aware resolvers or applications through the use of cryptographic digital signatures. In other words, signing something in DNS, and we'll be talking about exactly what in a second. They write, these digital signatures are included in secured zones as resource records. Security can be provided even though non-security-aware DNS servers, even through non-security-aware DNS servers in many cases. The extensions, which they proposed in 1997, also provide, they write, for the storage of authenticated public keys in the DNS. This storage of keys can support general public key distribution service as well as DNS security. Of course, we've talked about that too, and I will in a second. The stored keys enable security-aware resolvers to learn the authenticating key of zones in addition to those for which they are initially configured, meaning they're able to acquire new information through the system and know that that's also authenticated and has not been modified. They finish saying keys associated with DNS names can be retrieved to support other protocols. Provision is made for a variety of key types and algorithms. So, okay, so that was RFC 2065. Today, 20 years later, we have a set of three, 4033, 34, and 35, which obsolete not only 2065, the original one, but 2535, 3008, 3090, 3445, 3655, 3658, 3755, 3757, and 3845, while updating 1034, 1035, 2136, 2181, 2308, 3225, 3007, 3597, and 3226. In other words, this has been a hard problem to solve. And they didn't even come close to getting it right out of the box. In fact, it was so badly wrongly done the first time that the original design was completely scrapped. It required I remember six back and forth messaging transactions, which when they started thinking about how to deploy this and get it working at scale, they realized, well, it won't. It would not scale to the size of the internet. So it was completely scrapped and work was begun again. For a while, the IETF was calling it DNSSEC-BIS, B-I-S, to sort of differentiate it from what was originally created. And finally, it just ended up replacing that wholesale among all of those RFCs, which have been scrapped and replaced and obsoleted and amended over the last 20 years. And we've talked about this promise, for example, of DANE, D-A-N-E, as a maybe someday possible future replacement for the existing certificate hierarchy that we're using currently, where we have all these many, many hundreds of trusted certificate authorities whose signatures we trust on anything that they sign. The promise that of DANE, which stands for DNS-based authentication of named entities, D-A-N-E, is that if this were to happen, a website like, for example, GRC, could itself securely publish its server's public key. That's right now what the certificate is that GRC sends to a client, and which has been signed by someone that the client trusts so that it can trust the certificate. Well, if we had a secure way of distributing those public keys through DNS, which we don't today, even 20 years later, then the domain itself could say, here's the public key of our web server, so that clients that were able to get that through DNSSEC, that is a secure DNS channel, would be able to say, oh, good. Now I've got the public key directly from the source rather than through a level of indirection through the certificate hierarchy system that we have today. So again, and I've often waxed on about just what it would mean to have a truly secure global directory system where using a DNS name-based system, it would be possible to distribute more than IP addresses, more than references to email, more than DKIM signatures. I mean, you know, do something really secure. It's a foundation we could build a lot on top of. So what's the problem? Why 20 years? Why is this so hard? The problem is that DNS itself, standard DNS, that is the original DNS that, frankly, we're still using today, was, but increasingly less so. That is, as DNSSEC is beginning to happen, it was incredibly lean and elegantly designed, very lightweight. UDP was the protocol. So you just sent a query and you got a response. Just, it couldn't have been simpler. They came up with clever ways of compressing the data so the packets were small. Most of the queries and responses fit in one packet, so you don't have to set up a communications protocol in order to deal with out-of-order packets and the sort of stuff that TCP does. The problem is that doing DNS with no security is elegant and bordering on trivial. it's so simple, but adding security is complicated. It requires a huge addition, not just adding a couple things, a massive addition to the existing simple and lightweight DNS system. And a perfect analogy is TCP, where TCP allows you the transmission control protocol to establish a communication between endpoints over the internet, which protects you against packets arriving out of order and packets being lost and momentary hiccups. You know, it handles all of that work for us, but it was never in the beginning secure. That, security was an afterthought for the internet. So a perfect example is then we said, oh, well, we like TCP, but boy, we'd sure like to know who we're talking to and have what we're saying private. So, of course, SSL was the way we said, okay, let's add security to TCP. Well, that was SSL, and we had all these versions of it and all the mistakes made and all the fixes over time, and now TLS, and we're still working on getting it right. So that sort of puts into perspective how simple it is to do something that just works without a concern for security, and how surprisingly difficult it is. How many problems arise when you decide you want to add security? And it's not just that it's the addition of security. That is, it wouldn't have been any easier back in the beginning, except we would have had it from the start.
I once asked Vince Cerf if he had any regrets designing TCP/IP and the internet protocols, anything he would have done differently, and that's exactly what he said. He said, I would have put in crypto.
Yeah.
They didn't feel like it was necessary. It was just universities talking with one another.
Yes, well, back then it was a miracle that it worked at all.
Yes.
It's like,
it probably
wow.
couldn't have technically added reasonable crypto just because there wasn't the
correct
power
back
to
then
do
there,
it.
We didn't have the processing power.
Yeah.
I mean, and so the advantage to it being there from the beginning would have only been that we wouldn't have the adoption inertia. And that's right. really what we're seeing.
They could have put the hooks in without implementing it, something like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what was interesting is that in reading a little more into this in order to talk about it for the podcast, I ran across several notes that noted that Dan Kaminsky's discovery of the problems with DNS, which we, of course, covered back at the time, I think it was 2008, really gave a good kick in the butt to DNSSEC, in the same way that Snowden's revelations about the NSA and how much true wiretapping was going on suddenly made us get a lot more serious about HTTPS and encryption. Similarly, I mean, it sort of took realizing how bad things were for the community to say, oh, okay, maybe we got to dust this off and think about it again. Okay, so the thing that put this on my radar was that October 11th, today is the 10th, we're recording this on October 10th, 2017. On October 11th, tomorrow, was to be the ICANN, what's called the KSK rollover, the key signing key rollover. We are currently using keys from 2010. The plan was to roll those over to 2017 keys, you know, just because it's a good thing to do. It allows us to have keys that are not so dated. So what happened was they said, we're not ready. So ICANN's announcement stated that the KSK, that's the key signing key rollover, is being delayed. They said, quote, because some recently obtained data shows that a significant number of resolvers, meaning DNS resolvers, used by ISPs and network operators are not yet ready for the key rollover. The availability, they wrote, of this new data is due to a very recent DNS protocol feature. See, they're still messing with this. They just, it hasn't even settled down yet. A very recent DNS protocol feature that adds the ability for a resolver, a DNS resolver, to report back to the root servers which keys it has configured. So, translation, after 20 years, DNSSEC is still being changed, messed around with, and not yet settled. They're adding things, and in this case, they added a feature which a few servers adopted, which then began reporting back about their keys. And although the data was incomplete and far from comprehensive, an analysis of it spooked them, because what they realized, the one thing they cannot do, DNS has been challenged enough as it is. The one thing they cannot do is break anything, because that would be a setback that, if avoidable, has to be avoided. So there is an annual meeting of the so-called DNS Operations Analysis and Research Center, OARC, known as DNS-OARC, OARC. It's one of the DNS organizational bodies. And Friday before last, I think it was September 29th, during this DNS-OARC annual general meeting, an engineer from VeriSign, Dwayne Wessels, presented the result of VeriSign's passive monitoring of DNS and DNSSEC in his talk, which was titled "A Look at RFC 8145." Okay, that's yet another RFC out in the 8000s, which is Trust Anchor Signaling for the 2017 KSK rollover. In other words, that's this new protocol, which had just recently been added, that allowed there to be some signaling of what was going on down from the top-level domains, down from the root servers, essentially. And the short version of his talk was that we're not ready. He said, this RFC describes how recursive name servers can signal up to authoritative servers the trust anchors that they have configured for DNSSEC validation. That is, are they configured? Shortly after its publication, there is a very popular DNS server called Unbound, which is sort of a play on the previous Unix standard server, which was Bind. So we have Bind and Unbound. So they said shortly after its publication, both Unbound and Bind implemented the specification. As organizations begin to deploy these new software versions, some of this key tag data is now appearing in queries to the root name servers. In other words, Unbound and Bind added this RFC 8145 trust anchor signaling. Then, as those versions of Unbound and Bind started to sort of percolate out into the world, as a sort of a side effect of their support for RFC 8145, they began sending this data back to the roots. And that's what allowed VeriSign to look at the data coming in and saying, oh, we better not do this. The world is not ready. So they wrote, this is useful data for key signing key rollovers. That is this KSK rollover, and especially for the root. Since the feature is very new, the number of recursive name servers providing data is not as significant as one might like for the upcoming root KSK rollover. Even so, it will be interesting to look at the data. And so he does so. And essentially, in a, I think it was a 27-slide presentation, he demonstrates like where we stand. And based on this, ICANN soberly decided to kill the long-planned rollover from the 2010 key signing keys to new 2017 key signing keys, because the data demonstrated, though it was fragmentary, that we weren't ready. Okay, so where are we today if we're not ready? We're actually making pretty good progress. There's a map here in the show notes, Leo, that might be interesting if you wanted to put it up. Very colorful, showing from red to green, from 0% to 100% of the domains which are signed. So we have the top level domains, things like, you know, .cc, .ru, .com, .gov, .edu, you know, the, basically the far right hand side. 89% of the top level domain zones are signed. So that's very good. 89%. So of the top levels, and just shy of half, 47% of the country code top level domains, you know, like .it for Italy, .ly for Libya, and so forth. So half of those are signed. Not nearly as good as the main top levels, but still pretty good. Second level domains are far lesser signed. For example, GRC is not yet signed. It's like on my, yeah, I'll get around to that after I stop using Windows XP. But for example, 2.5 million .nl, that is the Netherlands domains, are signed. That's about a little shy of half of theirs. 88% of .gov are signed, which is nice. Where it's like, you know, the government is trying to set an example by signing its. Over 50% of the Czech Republic .cz are signed. A quarter of .br, Brazil, are signed. However, they note, while only 0.5%, okay, half of 1% of the zones in .com are signed, still there are so many .com domains that the half a percent is 600,000 zones. So a good chunk of zones are signed. The major DNS authoritative server software and libraries now support DNSSEC and have several years of development experience. So, and as I was browsing around in more detail, you know, basically all the different languages have libraries, you know, Python and Perl and Java and, like, you know, and .NET, and, you know, all of them now have libraries which offer DNSSEC as a feature of them. And it's all public and open source. So that's a good requirement. Also, management tools have started to come online to assist in the deployment. I'm sure I will take advantage of of some of that when I get ready to do this. I do need to make sure that I'll be able to leave subdomains unsigned, because I have several that are dynamic where the DNS is varying arbitrarily, and it's a pain to sign something that is completely dynamic. But I'm sure that there's a way to set that up correctly. Also, encryption algorithms are maturing. We were at shorter key lengths. We're moving to longer key lengths. We're also beginning to move to elliptic keys, which is a huge win. As we know, the huge advantage of an elliptic key is that because the problem that it represents is harder than factoring, we're able to use shorter keys to get the equivalent strength as with RSA factoring-based problems. And shorter is better for DNS. One of the biggest problems is that to get cryptographic security with RSA, which has been the primary algorithm used, the keys had to be big. Well, but the actual DNS query is tiny. So this is, again, one of the problems. I mean, it suddenly the bandwidth was going to jump up. The load on the servers was going to jump up. DNS servers, as we've often discussed here, are notoriously overworked and they get no respect, much like Rodney Dangerfield. They're in a closet somewhere and they never complain. So no one ever bothers them. So anyway, it's just that we're moving forward, but with a lot of inertia. In terms of validation, one of the problems that still exists is that to get end-to-end security, we need to also encrypt the last mile, as it's called, from the ISP to the end user. So it's one thing for a DNS server that requests on behalf of its user some information, and for that server to be able to verify the information that it got was correct. But if it then sends it to the user unencrypted, unprotected, then that last mile could technically still be subverted. So what we still need to do is to come up with a means of either encrypting that, and there are some non-DNSSEC approaches for doing that, or have the client itself verify DNS. So that instead of just saying, give me the IP for this, it says, give me the records I need to verify the response that you're going to give me, and it performs that. In other words, we need DNS validating resolvers in the clients, and those are coming too. Those are a little bit further behind, but they're on the way. So anyway, we're moving forward. It's a function of, it's a hard problem to solve. It's had a deleterious and dramatic impact, and there's been this sense of, well, what we have now is working. If it's not broken, don't fix it. And what that just means is that it's just taking time. But nothing could happen because this is a hierarchical system. It had to start at the top and then filter down. The roots are all signed. We're seeing that the top level domains and the second level domains are getting signed. And we're at the point now where it's just my own inertia doesn't have GRC signed, but there are a lot, DNSSEC is finally beginning to happen. And where are we? We're at episode 632. I think by 999, we'll probably be pretty well established.
Because you're retiring at 1,000, so.
Oh, I'm running out of digits, Leo.
We better do it by one. Really, it's going to take that long? Wow, 999.
Yeah, I just think it's going to be, yes. I think what we'll see is high security use places where it'll be available and it'll be used where it really matters, very much like HTTPS. You know, we had HTTPS for a long time, whereas lots of blogging sites said, I don't need that.
Right.
You know, and it wasn't until Let's Encrypt made it absolutely simple. Or for example, WordPress said, yeah, we're just going to support it everywhere.
Right.
You know, bang.
Right.
It, you know, so there will, it'll start being used, but even then it won't be used pervasively. That'll take more time. But yeah, it is clear that it's happening. It's not that it's not happening. I would argue it's happening more than IPv6 is. But there's another example of something not in a hurry.
Well, I think it shows, unless there's something forcing it, it's just not. It's,
yes.
There's too much inertia. It's just not gonna.
Yes.
Not gonna happen.
Yes.
Steve did it again. Lovely show. If you want to get a copy of this show and share with your friends. Well, first of all, if you're listening at home, you probably already have a copy. But for future reference, Steve puts this show on his website, grc.com. That's where you'll find SpinRite, his daily bread, the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. You'll also find information about Squirrel and perfect paper passwords and password haystacks. And it just goes on and on and on. All that stuff's free, grc.com. The podcast is there. So is a transcript, so you can read along as you listen. A lot of people find that's a little easier to do if you read it and you understand it better, whatever way suits you. We have audio and video as well on our website at twit.tv/SN. You can download it there, or you can also subscribe from there. And I encourage you to subscribe. Whatever podcast appliance you use, a subscription means you'll have every episode automatically. Our feeds only include the most recent 10, so you want to start now. Start building your collection. It's very important. Overcast, Pocket Cast, very popular. iTunes, of course. Stitcher, Slacker. You can even listen on your Amazon Echo. You say, Echo, listen to Security Now on TuneIn. TuneIn's our purveyor on the Echo. Or watch Twit Live if you want to watch the live stream on TuneIn. We do that every Tuesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern. For the next couple of weeks, 20:30 UTC, but we are going to slide back when we fall back. And go back to Standard Time, Western Pacific Standard Time. Steve, thanks once again for a fabulous episode, and we will see you next week.
We have no idea what next week will bring, but we will cover it, whatever it is. And I really do thank our listeners for sending me things they find that are of interest. It helps to pull all this together, and I just want to say thanks.
I forget to mention that, and I should do that since we don't do the Q&A anymore. I forget that you can go to grc.com/feedback. He's got a form there, or tweet him. That's probably the best, most instant way to do it, instantly gratifying. It's just 140 characters. Some of you, 280 characters now, at SGGRC, and he does accept DMs as well as public tweets at SGGRC.
Yes, in fact, someone sent me last night, I ran across a clearly a 280-character tweet. I was so jealous. It's like,
I know.
Oh, look at that.
I know. I don't have it yet.
It's amazing what a difference it makes just to double. I mean, it's like, okay, this is better.
I wonder, though, how it's going to change Twitter. I mean, the stream will now be a bunch of long posts. I don't know.
True.
I don't know.
Interesting to see.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Steve. We'll see you next time.
Okay, buddy. Thanks. Security.